morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And Rabideau is getting closer and closer to Gobble Day.
It is indeed, and we have a Gobble Day special program. Well, sort of, anyway.
A semi-Gobble
Day special program, because getting ready for Gobble Gobble Day, we came across a device that no home cook who's cooking for Thanksgiving should be without, a brand spanking new roaster.
Right.
New design and all. If a roaster can be sexy, this one is. Let's hear all about it.
We're talking to Stephanie Beck, who is National Sales Manager at Meyer Corporation U.S., and she's going to be telling us what kinds of equipment we need to produce a fabulous holiday meal with almost no effort at all. Right, Stephanie?
That's correct.
First of all, tell us, what is Meyer Corporation U.S.?
Meyer Corporation is a cookware company based in the California Bay Area, and we've been manufacturing cookware for over 30 years, and we manufacture cookware for some of our own brands, Anolon and Circulon, and we also manufacture cookware for certain licensed brands, including KitchenAid, which we're going to be talking about the KitchenAid roaster later. And then Bonjour is a brand that we own, purchased that company about 3 years ago, and it is renowned for many gourmet specialty items, including our torch, which we'll talk about.
Now, Stephanie, we started this process with using a roaster on a turkey mm-hmm. breast. Tell us about this roaster. It was big. I must say it was very big, but the product was very good.
It is. The roaster is a little over 16 inches long, so it's very good size to do up to about a 20-pound turkey. What's unique about the KitchenAid roaster that we designed for this season is its particular design and shape. It's very retro. It reminds you of the 1950s. And all the wonderful home-cooked meals that Mom and Grandma used to make.
Well, then I said to your publicist, Julia, that it's an icon in the kitchen. That was why. It was taking me back to my mother's roaster.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Absolutely.
And does it come in colors other than red? I mean, we got a red one, which is just marvelous looking.
It comes in the stunning red and also in black.
Black.
There we go. Well, mm-hmm. According to physics... It's the very best color to conductings, which is
right.
why your black pots are so good.
That's
but
correct.
What's the roaster is deceptively conventional, in a way, because it's covered in enamel, just like the one my mother mm-hmm. had throughout her whole life.
Mm-hmm.
Probably got it as a wedding present and was still using it 60 years later. But there's probably something different in the sandwich under the enamel, isn't there?
That's correct. So there's actually stainless steel underneath the enamel. So that's the metal that gives it the strength and the durability and the heft. I mean, it's a sizable roaster. It's got very good heft to it. On top of it, it also has a wonderful cover, lid. So can, you know, roast a turkey with it uncovered if you would desire. If you're doing something smaller like a pork loin roast or something, a turkey breast like you mentioned, and you wanted to cover it in case it was getting too brown too quickly, instead of having to, you know, fool with Reynolds wrap or tenting, you can actually cover the roaster, which is a wonderful feature.
Now, that's what I did. I cooked it most of the time mm-hmm. with the lid on.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to have a very beneficial effect. I guess it was sort of steaming and with the wine and broth that I put in it as well as cooking at the same time. Now, curiously enough, we had Chef Michael Simon from Cleveland on the. We interviewed him. In fact, his interview might be in this program. You never can tell
mm-hmm.
because we cooked according to his recipe. And he said that the biggest problem that people have when they're cooking in a roaster or in an oven generally is they open the door far too often.
Right, which allows you to escape.
Exactly, and then you have to start over again. So you're using more fuel and you're using precious cooking time. So would you feel the same way as he does?
Absolutely. And the nice benefit about the cover is that you can, you know, cover the roaster and allow the vapors and the moisture to continue to almost self-baste the turkey breast or chicken or even a pork loin. So so that you're putting moisture right back into the piece of meat and slow cooking it, as well as when you are finished with a piece of meat, such as a pork loin or a turkey, you want to let it rest for a good 15 or 20 minutes. That allows the juices to somewhat redistribute. And again, with the cover, you can do that instead of having to tinfoil and create tents and that type of thing.
Do you cook, Stephanie?
I cook a lot. I'm a home economist by trade.
Okay, you sounded like you knew your way around.
Before we leave that thought, so you're saying that the resting should be done with the lid on?
That's correct.
Okay, well, I wasn't sure about that, and I think I might have rested our turkey breast with having taken it out of the pan already, and that was obviously the wrong thing to do. So the idea is that you rest it in the roaster with the lid on.
Exactly.
Okay, well, you learn a little something every day.
Well, now we're getting our listeners up to date on all the things, the fancy new things that they can use to facilitate production of this great feast. Mm-hmm. And you've done a list of it. Now, the next one on your list is a sore spot with me, actually.
Kitchen
fork? No, the clip-on kitchen timer.
Clip-on kitchen timer.
Tell us about that. I mean, my problem with the timer is Peter times absolutely everything in the house, the laundry, the cooking, so that my whole life is filled with these little things going off, going
right. I think one of the challenges about, you know, preparing a Thanksgiving dinner is that, by and large, we only cook things of that nature, a turkey, large piece of pork or beef, once or twice a year. And
right.
If we're having a large group of people over, that certainly can add more stress to the situation. And the idea is to try to have everything come out at the perfect time. So while we may not like timers and hearing dings and bells, that day it's very, very important. Otherwise, some things end up undercooked, some things end up overcooked, or we forget, you know, where we are in the process.
I'm with you, Stephanie. So okay, so now we've got a timer. Now what's next?
So the kitchen timer is a manual timer. It works very easy. You can clip it to your apron. You can clip up a recipe. And so it's doing a multitude of different things for you, but very handy to have in the kitchen. And while we were talking about the turkey cooking process, which is probably somewhat of the most nerve-wracking for certainly the novice cook and even an experienced cook, Bonjour Chef's laser probe thermometer is one of those items that I think is just a necessity. We all hear about foodborne illness, and we certainly don't want to get our guests sick, and it's very important to make sure that we are cooking whatever the meat may be to the ideal temperature. And so the Bonjour laser probe thermometer has two functions. It's able to tell you the temperature of the oven accurately that you're sticking the roaster into, for instance. And then it actually takes an internal temperature as well and gives you the recommended temperature for a finished turkey, a finished pork loin, a tenderloin, a beef tenderloin, so that you don't feel like you're guessing. A lot of people get very nervous when they, you know, are the juices running clear? You know,
I know. Yeah, that's vague, isn't it?
Yeah, the last thing you want is one of those plastic doohickeys that pops out.
Right.
Because you can be damn sure the bird is cooked.
It's overcooked
by the time that boy comes out.
A liability issue, probably.
Okay, let's keep going here.
Now, you and I were talking before about this induction burner, mm-hmm. which is one of my dream wishes, actually, to have one of those, because it speeds up cooking, and it just seems like everything should be induction in the future. Could you do a turkey with an induction burner?
No, because you're not going to, a burner is only going to give you direct heat source from the bottom. So that's not going to be able to roast a turkey like an oven does. You know, an oven fully surrounds the roaster. So it won't do that. But the beauty of an induction burner, and this particular one is a mobile. So you could put it on a buffet so that, you know, if you had your sweet potato casserole was finished, but we weren't quite ready to serve yet, you could sit it on a buffet, keep it on a warm temperature. If something needed to actually come back to a boil, you could actually raise it to, I mean, it covers seven different temperature ranges.
And the big advantage is it warms up very fast, right?
Exactly.
And it's electric? It must be electric.
It is. It is electric. The other nice feature is that, let's say it's on a buffet, and let's say you have some younger children in the grandchildren or children or friends of whatever, you don't have to worry about them being able to hurt themselves, burn themselves. The actual surface of the induction burner does not get hot. It's only the connection between the burner and the pot itself So it's a very safe thing to have out in an open crowd, if you will, as well as being very beneficial.
Now, you've got a special line of cookware that's designed to go along with that too, right?
We do. Infinite Circulon was designed and introduced in the market about 2 years ago. It is induction suitable. It's all stovetop suitable, but particularly because it has a stainless steel base, it is induction suitable. And then actually we have a new line called Anilon Nouvelle Copper, which is just beautiful. So we know that copper is a fabulous conductor of heat, and then it has the induction base on the bottom. So regardless of how you want to use it, on induction or on a traditional gas or electric stove, it's just a wonderful collection of cookware.
That was the collection that was on my script.
Oh, okay.
which is why I asked you the question. Now we've got one last little toy, which is designed to go with dessert.
Well, dessert and savory. I just was reading through some recipes. I'd love to try at least two new recipes during, you know, a holiday feast. So whether it's Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever, I like to experiment a little bit. So I'll usually do two or three new recipes each outing. And one of the recipes I was looking at was a wonderful appetizer, and it calls for using the torch to toast the breadcrumbs on the mushrooms at the end. Instead of having to use precious oven space, everything else is jockeying for oven space, you can take out your kitchen torch and do the toasting of the marshmallows on the sweet potatoes, or if something is a meringue pie, you can actually finish that, toasted breadcrumbs. So you don't have to constantly be opening the oven door, putting things in, or having to jockey around for time in the oven.
Well, people's kitchens are so much better equipped today than when I was growing up.
Well, they are if you get all these gadgets to put in them.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So let's do a recap, shall we, Stephanie? Well,
sure.
We need a roaster.
Yes, you need a roaster. That's the basic.
Absolutely, need a roaster.
And
you need a clip-on kitchen timer. You need a kitchen torch for dessert or for the other things you mentioned.
The appetizer.
If you need an extra burner, you need an induction burner and some pots to go along with it.
That's correct.
Sounds like there might be quite a lot of things in people's Christmas stockings this year, don't you think?
They do make wonderful gift ideas. And once you've used them, you're hooked. It makes the whole process of preparing a meal for family or friends even more enjoyable.
Tell me one thing that you actually could not produce a Thanksgiving or any other holiday feast without one item.
Well, it would probably be the roaster. That really is the basic element to creating the cornerstone of the meal. So it probably would be a good roaster. You can make gravy in the roaster after you've taken the bird out. So it has a lot of wonderful features.
Yeah, I will add one thing to the things that I thought was great about it. Put in some potatoes. And sometimes those pesky vegetables you put beside the turkey don't cook fast enough.
Right.
And this roaster certainly did the job in making sure that. Now, the thing I didn't figure out how to do, which is something my mother knew how to do, but I'm sure I could figure it out, is how to make the wonderful English-style roasted potatoes, which are so crispy, crunchy on the outside. But I think the missing ingredient there was enough fat.
Oh, yeah.
To be able to make
if
sure
it's
that
English,
you
English, it has to be fat.
That is actually the key ingredient to any good meal.
I know. Well, that's true, isn't it? Yorkshire pudding, you have to have the fat, too.
Will you be cooking for Thanksgiving?
Actually, I am going to be treated this Thanksgiving. My husband's younger sister is getting married, and so she and her fiancé are hosting our large extended family in San Antonio, but I'm going to be bringing a dessert and several vegetables and an appetizer, so that's why I was looking for some new recipes.
Well, we need your torch.
We hope you'll have a wonderful time. Well, listeners, we hope you'll all have a wonderful time at Thanksgiving, too. On the menu, certainly intends to. We'll be in South Carolina with our son and daughter-in-law and two wonderful grandchildren, and we can't wait to do that, and I'm sure you can't wait to head for San Antonio and visit the Alamo and do whatever else you do there, as well as cooking Thanksgiving dinner. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us.
You're a delight, Stephanie. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we have to get all ready, but now we're going to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. As we always do at this time in the program, we say stay connected. Just click on any of those little buttons on our website so you can send us emails or Twitter with us or talk to us on Facebook, make suggestions, whatever. That's the rule of the game now.
It is the rule of the game. If we don't hear from you, we get very glum.
Glum.
And
right.
We get very glum at this time of the year anyway, so you must cheer us up by giving us some new things to think about and some new ideas.
As we get from this next interviewee, Michael Simon.
Took us a long time to get around to interviewing Michael Simon.
Everybody, his cookbook's really special.
Everybody told us he was a great chef and we should go to his restaurant. We never succeeded in doing that. But we did catch up with him about his first cookbook, and it's a really extraordinary effort. And he's a very extraordinary man. And we're putting him right next to the roaster before Thanksgiving because we talked to him about how to make sure your bird turns out perfect. So be sure to listen all the way through.
Chef Michael Simon lives to cook, and that's the title of his new book. And listeners, it is one swell cookbook. It's one of the ones I will personally keep and use frequently. Michael, welcome to On the Menu. Your book is subtitled, well, it's titled, I guess, Michael Simon's Live to Cook, and the subtitle, Recipes and Techniques to Rock Your Kitchen, which is an appropriate subtitle for somebody who we cheered when you won Iron Chef America. We just cheered.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun. It's always better to have people cheer for you than against you.
Well, this is true. Well, we loved it, and you did a fabulous job. Now, this book is also a fabulous job. It's you have a foreword by Bobby Flay here. I said to you that it's just the kind of book that has so much substance that it's absolutely necessary to put it on your kitchen shelf. You talk about things that other people don't talk about. I'd say overall, though, my first impression of this is it conveys your passion about food. And so the book has a whole lot of personality and passion for food. And that's what you wanted. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, we always say that we want our food when we're cooking at the restaurants or even when Liz and I are eating at home or how the food that I was raised on. I always want to eat food that is soulful, food that you could feel as well as taste. And so it was really important for me to get that across in the book for people to understand, this food has got some guts to it and it has a little bit of personality to it. And that you could do the same thing in your own kitchen. Your food should take on the personality of you. People should feel it as they eat it. And I just think that's so important.
So this is your first book.
This is my first book. I've been featured in some books before, done recipes for books before, but this is the first book I've ever done.
And you said something at the beginning of the book about a few ingredients or something like that. I can't remember exactly what you said, but you said if you can't do it in...
Two pans.
Two pans, that's what it is.
Yeah, if you can't make a two-pan dish, sometimes it's just not worth the hassle.
Yeah, well, we should point out that this is really meant for the home cook, this cookbook, as many other cookbooks, which I admire, are not. I mean, they're just...
Well, and I think a lot of times, the thing that I didn't want it to be is, sometimes you see chef cookbooks, and nothing against any of these chefs, but so-and-so cooks at home, five-star recipes to cook at home, and I mean, we just wanted to do the recipes that we actually do cook at home and recipes that we do in the restaurants that you can cook at home. So I didn't want to dumb it down for the home cook, and I wanted to make it something that you can attain at home and something that a young cook or a young professional chef that could be very valuable to them also.
And you say you can be a better cook, and what's essential is, first of all, you have to know how to shop.
Oh, God, it is the most important thing. It doesn't matter if you've been cooking your entire life for a week, for a day, how well you know yourself or know how good you are around the kitchen. If you start with crappy ingredients, chances are you're going to end up with a crappy dish.
Oh, yeah.
If you start with great food, your odds of putting together a great meal have just been increased by an incredible amount. I'm going to season it right, and you use some of the techniques that we teach in the book, and you're just naturally going to create better dishes. And you're going to love the process more, too. There's nothing better than being able to go to a farmer's market or go to a great grocery store that really takes pride in the product that they're selling, and it's humanely raised and naturally raised and organic, not only does the food taste a lot better, but it's a lot better for you, and it just feels right.
Now, how do you find farmers market shopping in Cleveland, which has a distinct season when not much grows, just like Pittsburgh and a lot of the northern United States?
Oh, well, they have one of the best farmers market.
Well,
no, I understand, but I mean, there are seasons of the year when...
Well, here's the right thing, though. But for me, the seasons become a very exciting part of the way I eat. Like, believe me, in the depth of a Cleveland winter, or, you know, a Pittsburgh winter, or any of, like, a New York winter, there are part of you that would always love to have a fresh tomato. But the reality is that tomato's going to taste like garbage.
Yes.
So, to wait until you get that beautiful tomato from your own soil, from the city that you live in, or your own garden, it makes it 100 times as special.
So you take tomatoes off the menu?
Oh, absolutely. The only tomatoes I have on the menu in the wintertime are ones that I've jarred and canned.
Oh, that's wonderful. We had a wonderful season. Everybody complained about their tomato season this year. I think we must have just been dumb and lucky.
I had a great tomato season.
And we had twice as many plants as I originally intended. And we had an absolutely wonderful crop. And
we had a beautiful crop this year, too, and I was thrilled with it. I think that's the exciting thing about eating seasonally. You know, in wintertime, you know, squashes are great. Braised root vegetables are, you know, to shave a beet salad is delicious. To shave some fennel is delicious. To cook down some celery root with potatoes and parsnips and carrots, that's a great side. So you could eat within the seasons and still go to these markets and still get these wonderful products. And that's another reason I put a big section in the book about pickling, because...
Yeah, I was going to say, you have some unusual sections in the book, and one of them is pickling. I was amazed that you had such a big section.
It's a lost art. Pickling is so great. Like, you know, you have a garden at the end of the season, you have all these green tomatoes on the vine, and you can make green tomatoes and have these great things to put on sandwiches, to top a steak with, all this great stuff that you could do.
Well, you have some unusual things in here, like pickled lamb's tongue. So that it's an exciting book, too. It's not just a basics. You have some interesting... Here's turnip kraut right next to pickled lamb's tongue.
Right. Well, again, like, when we did the book, like I said earlier, I didn't want to dumb it down. I wanted it to be the real deal and how I feel about food. And is everybody going to try pickled lamb tongue, or is it for everybody? It's not, but it's a great thing to know how to do. Now, is my mom's lasagna something that everybody's going to want to make at home and eat? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's still a great dish, and it's still done the right way and taught to me by my mother, who is an amazing cook. And so I just wanted it to kind of be a little all-encompassing like that.
Now, you have a charcuterie section, too.
I do. I love making fresh sausages and salamis and curing our own bacon and making confits. And, again, is it something that every cook is going to dive into? No, but there's a lot of joy, I think, in making your own sausages or making your own bacon or confiting a leg of duck.
Yeah, Peter's always itching to get into that, and
That was all Ruben's fault, because he wrote a...
That charcuterie
This is your good buddy, Michael, right? And he wrote a book about charcuterie with someone who really knew about it.
Absolutely. Michael's... the charcuterie book by Michael and by Folsom is a beautiful book.
Yeah, it's good.
That's it. So,
beautiful book.
So we had a duck breast, and I said, "Well, I know I can do something with this, hanging it in my basement," and it seemed really easy. But Anne put the kibosh on it. She said, "You can't do that. There's all kinds of things down there that might cause it to not taste very good."
Well, I mean, it used to be a jewelry workshop. I mean,
you can end up with a haunted basement. You don't want to do that.
Everybody should have a little
asbestos and heavy metal,
you know,
right?
A little heavy metal in the food. Never. Michael, why don't you pick a couple of your favorite recipes out of the book, if you can. And then sort of take us through them so that people can understand the thought process and realize that they can do it too.
Yeah, especially hit on some of these things that you talk about that a lot of cookbooks don't talk about, the importance of salting, which I think is absolutely probably one of the most important things in cooking, knowing how to salt. And then also on your balancing and your emphasis on balancing acidity and how that perks up. Do you have examples of that?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, we live in a wonderful but very phobic country. So afraid of fat. We're so afraid of salt. We're so afraid of all these things. And then in that same breath, people are so comfortable going to the store and buying something that's in a box, a can, or a bag. You know, when there is so much sodium in a can of soup or a bag of chips or one of those things, there is no way that you're going to put that much salt in something that you're making from scratch. So typically, if people would just cut out all that processed junk, they're going to be fine with seasoning their food with a little bit of vigor, for lack of other terms. So when you take an onion and slice it up with a little bit of garlic and some vegetables, and you sweat those out in the pan, if you don't season those when they go in the pan, you're selling those vegetables short. They're never going to reach their full body of sweetness. They're never going to reach their peak of flavors. And so now you just, in my opinion, you wasted money. You just gave your, you blew an opportunity to receive a full flavor, whatever you're cooking.
So your belief is you put the salt in at the beginning?
Yeah, you put the salt in the beginning and then you build. Because every time that salt hits the food, it makes it reach its pinnacle of flavor. Salt will make an onion sweeter. It'll make it caramelize correctly.
We had this discussion with, we have some friends coming over, and we were going to do turkey breast in a new roaster that I'm testing from KitchenAid. And anyhow, I said to Peter, well, Michael said you have to salt it first. And he said, well, I wasn't planning on dirtying another bowl.
So I cleaned the turkey just like you said,
and I opened the book that Turkey 101.
So we're doing Turkey Breast 101, and I washed it and I patted it dry, and I salted it and then I put it in the roasting pan.
Well, what happens when you could salt a piece of protein a little bit in advance is it actually helps it become moister and take on flavor better.
We were talking exactly the opposite.
I'm actually really familiar with that, and I do that a lot. The only exception was last evening we had a piece of, was it hanger steak?
Yeah.
From a grass-fed beef company, and I said, you know what, I want to find out what this really tastes like.
So I added just
a little bit of salt when I was cooking it, and some fresh ground pepper, and cooked it that way. But it was only because I really wanted to
taste the flavor
without enhancing it the way I ordinarily would. Ordinarily, I do exactly as you describe it. In fact, I have a wonderful home cook's Jacquard machine, and I use that a lot too.
Well, I don't believe in those.
The combination, you eat your pork chops that way almost all the time without realizing it.
Well, I realize it, but I don't really care.
You don't really care.
About jacquarding things. But did you hear of a jacquard?
I do not, no.
No, I never heard of it either.
I mean, I've heard of it, I just never have used one. But I'm sure it's fabulous.
It does a great job of opening up the meat, and if you add some salt as well, it does both combined. It will make an average pork chop into a much better pork chop.
Yeah, absolutely. The salt gets in there, breaks down the structure, and it helps the meat release its moisture when you eat it.
You know,
that's why it's so much more flavor.
That's the absolute opposite of what everybody taught us growing up.
Oh, I know. It's like an old wives' tale.
Yeah, it draws out all the moisture if you salt your...
Right.
Paul Newman went on about his hamburgers. Do you remember that? About how you absolutely must not salt them first?
I do not remember that.
Yeah.
That's why I was an actor, not a chef.
Well, you know what? But when I do make hamburgers, I don't salt the mix. I salt the exterior of the burger.
Okay.
Right.
I liked Paul Newman so much, it's hard for me to disagree with him.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I mean, I was very careful when he was alive and I never took advantage of my friendship with Michelle to ask if I could interview Paul Newman.
She thought about it. It did cross her mind. Now back to a couple of recipes, Michael.
Okay, Michael, you were explaining to us your theories in specific recipes. Do you want to do beef cheek?
The beef cheek pierogi is the recipe that we kind of Lola was built on. It's what we've been doing at the restaurant since the beginning. It's the recipe that got so much press and took the humble pierogi kind of to another level. Like when I became a chef, with cousin my dad's Eastern European roots,
you have to talk me into pierogies. I once judged a pierogi contest, and I thought I was swallowing rocks.
She also thought she thought she was going to die.
Well, these are, the dough's very light and flaky. Sometimes people freak out about beef cheeks, and my comment to them all the time is, do you like pot roast? And typically they'll say yes, and I'll say, well, that's typically made with the rump of the animal. So why are you so comfortable eating the rump and so uncomfortable eating the cheek? I have absolutely no idea.
Oh, that's funny.
It's a cut of meat that is relatively inexpensive, and when you braise it down, it just becomes incredibly tender and succulent and makes just a wonderful filling for the pierogi. We top it with a little bit of horseradish cream to something that could cut through the richness of the beef. The zip of the horseradish really cuts through it, and it gets the earthiness from the mushrooms, and it's just a beautifully balanced dish. Some of the other dishes that I really love in the recipe, in the cookbook, is I love the dates recipe.
The what?
The roasted dates with the pancetta.
I was just going to ask you about that, because that sounded fabulous to me.
So easy to make, and you could put it together in minutes, and you get sweetness, you get acidity, you get salt, you get a little bit of heat, and again, it really kind of sums up the way I like to cook it. I never want to go too far in one direction. If I'm cooking a rich piece of meat, I think it's very important to top it with something that has texture, that has acidity and crispness to it. Would never take a big old steak and put it on top of mashed potatoes, because there's nothing there to excite my palate. There's no textural changes. It's rich on rich, soft on soft. Now, to cook, you know, a steak or ribeye or something like that and top it with a salad of like pickled onions and arugula and some chilies and olive oil and lemon, it wakes up my palate as I'm eating that steak. And it makes it an exciting dish, not just something that every single bite tastes the same and just lays on my palate.
Yeah, just chewing that steak drives me nuts.
Here's what I'd suggest before we conclude, because partly because I'm really interested in getting insight, because we're going to cook a turkey breast with a modified Michael Simon recipe this evening. But secondly, we're probably going to broadcast this interview in the same program as the roaster, getting ready for Thanksgiving and Christmas. So why don't we take the turkey recipe through and give us a couple of the hints that really make it successful as far as you're concerned? A
couple of things that I like to do, obviously. I like to season it in advance, and we talked about that, how it opens up that protein, allows it to take on flavor. When you bite into it, it's super juicy because the cell structure is broken down a little bit. The other thing, a couple huge mistakes I think people make when they're roasting turkey: do not put stuffing inside the bird. It works as a sponge. You fill it with bread, and the bread in the middle just essentially sucks moisture out of the turkey as it cooks, and then you have to cook the turkey further than you should to get the stuffing up to a temperature that's safe.
Okay.
So I always do the stuffing on the side.
Great tip there.
The other thing is people like to open the door, close the door, open the door, close the door, baste, don't baste, you know, back and forth. I take a cheesecloth and I soak it in some butter and stock and herbs and to really build up the flavor of it. And I cover the turkey with that and close the door. And then it self-bastes itself throughout the entire process. You don't have to worry about the temperature of the oven going up and down, up and down.
Now, do you keep the lid on the roaster, Michael, or not?
No, I keep it open.
You keep it open.
And with about, when I get to a point, I think it's a great thing that people could purchase too is a thermometer that you could plug into the bird and set it on the outside of your oven.
That's interesting.
Get it at hardware stores. They're not that expensive. And I cook my turkeys to 160 in the oven, and then I let them rest after that. And it'll tell you when it's done. And you, again, you don't have to probe and check and guess, and it takes all the guesswork out of it.
Well, you heard it here first, folks. So you're going to be armed for Thanksgiving. You're going to be ready for Christmas. You can have your turkey the Michael Simon way. Michael?
I want to.
And let the bird rest. That's the last thing I want to say.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
take it out of people and hack into it. Let that sucker sit for a good 20, 30 minutes.
Now, I think that would be remiss if we did not mention your restaurants. I mean, you're in Cleveland.
I was going to do that next.
Okay. Well, then why don't you do that?
No, why don't we invite Michael to do that? Because you have more than one, both in Cleveland.
I do. We have Lola, which we opened almost 14 years ago now, down on East 4th Street in downtown Cleveland, close to the Chew, which is the home of our beloved Cavaliers, our only sports team that chooses to win. We messy. We're making our own homemade bologna. We're making homemade bratwurst, grinding our own hamburgers. And that's on the east side of Cleveland in Eaton. And then we have one restaurant in Detroit, which is our giant homage to meat. And it's called Roast. And that's wonderful also.
Oh, yes. I read about that. I've never been there either.
Well, now, here's the thing. Have Shaq and LeBron been in yet? Are they regular customers?
LeBron comes in. He's been in over the years quite a bit. Shaq has not yet been in. Zilbrunas is a regular customer. Andy is a great customer. The Cavs have been very, very good to us over the years.
How about a website, Michael? Do you have a website?
Our website is lolabistro.com, and you can get to all our restaurants from there and the cookbooks and T-shirts and all that good stuff, Iron Chef schedules.
And the other thing I need to know is, are these really the tats on the back of your legs?
Those are real. Much to my mother's chagrin.
I'm sure your mother is chagrined.
Tell our listeners.
I got my first tattoo when I was 16. She said, "You're going to regret that for the rest of your life." And the 30 years that have followed that have just led to more tattoos. She's just given up.
Well, this one leg is just incredible. You have they're like butchering diagrams.
You have mutton veal
and pork.
In case I get confused when I'm doing Iron Chef, I can look down and see all the primary cuts.
Nothing if not a creative character. Well, listen, next on our adventure list, when we can venture as far as Cleveland is, we'll come and we'll sample some of these in person, and we'll record some more while we're there. In the meantime, thank you so much for being such a good sport, laboring on your cell phone because of telecom difficulties in New York City. Michael,
our standard hotel. Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, yeah, Michael. And I could talk to you forever, and everybody should get this book. Michael Simon's Live to Cook, Recipes and Techniques to Rock Your Kitchen, and it's certainly going to rock mine. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Oh, that was interesting. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again. We're rolling into our final segment, and I'm going to let you, Abbott O, explain the relationship between the next two interviews.
Well, they're both ways to make sure the sweet part of your party is a great success. One, because Gifford's ice cream from Maine is absolutely the most wonderful ice cream you've ever had. So, especially if you secretly don't say that it's from Gifford's in Maine, you say, "I made it myself, it's wonderfully homemade," you'll get all kinds of plaudits for your Thanksgiving or your Christmas or your other party dessert. And if you want to make sure your parties all go with a swing, we came across a wonderful book called Forking Fantastic.
These gals are really attracting a lot of attention.
Yeah, we have to watch very carefully how we say that, otherwise the FCC will be afterwards. But Forking Fantastic is something you can certainly listen to. So, first off, Gifford's ice cream, and then Forking Fantastic to finish out today's program.
Hello, Lindsay Gifford of Gifford's Ice Cream.
Hi there.
How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Okay.
Well, this is a great day for ice cream. I understand you have ice cream on the ground as well.
Yes, well, not today. It has melted, but yesterday, yes.
You know what we're referring to, of course, because Lindsay's from Maine, and if you watched a football game as I did yesterday, you know they probably got even more snow than the Patriots did in Foxborough.
Actually, the Patriots, they did get more snow than we did, so okay. We were a little lucky in that aspect.
They enjoyed it, and they probably gave themselves a treat of Gifford's ice cream afterwards.
I hope so. I know I did.
Yeah, well, the people who came to our house for dinner last night also wolfed down some Gifford's chocolate ice cream. And when we offered it to them, we said, they say this is the world's best chocolate ice cream. So go ahead, tell us why that is.
It is the way, we feel that it's the way that we make it. We use family recipes that are passed down through five generations. We make our own mix using fresh pasteurized milk and cream that is RBST-free from local family farm. We use 1940s vintage cherry burrell freezers. That it's a slow churn process, so we feel that it gives the best quality to the product. It's creamier. There's less ice crystals.
See, that's one thing I did notice. I don't know what you base quality judging ice cream on, except that I did notice the texture was so smooth and creamy.
Yes,
and light. It was light. It's not bulky in your mouth.
Right. Yeah, and that's our cherry burrell freezers. Again, they're in the 1940s, and they're not the slowest freezers, but we feel that because of the quality that it gives us the best job, even though it might not be the most efficient for us.
Well, it also must make for a rather more expensive product. How do you handle that in the marketplace?
It's all about the quality of the product, a premium product, and really once it sells itself, and hopefully you folks noticed that in your guests last night eating our product. But it really, once our customers taste the creaminess and just the quality with the inclusions and no ice crystals, and they just fall in love with it, and they're customers for life most of the time.
Yeah,
you got them
hooked.
Yeah, guess we're unique. We've got a little niche.
Now, was chocolate ice cream always the specialty?
Chocolate, vanilla. A lot of people use our vanilla and our basic flavors around the holidays, especially with, you know, the pies for Thanksgiving and Christmas. So chocolate and vanilla really are our two key flavors.
But then you snuck in that wonderful espresso one with the deer tracks in it. Tell our listeners about that one. That's our favorite.
Yes, Maine deer tracks. That's one of our fun, unique Maine flavors. It's a rich espresso ice cream, and it has crunchy Heath bar candies, and then it has a thick chocolate fudge ripple throughout it.
Well, why is it called deer tracks?
We just like to have fun with the flavors, really. A lot of the times my dad and uncle, they come up with the more unique flavors. Our most unique latest flavor addition is Maine lobster tracks.
Oh, that's funny.
What's in that? Oh, my goodness.
That's vanilla ice cream, and it doesn't have actual lobster, I will tell you that. We have been asked. It has little lobster-colored chocolate cups that are filled with caramel, and then it has like a Nestle eclair swirl throughout it.
Oh,
it's
my goodness.
Really good.
Well, how many do you have flavors altogether?
We have up in the probably high 50s or so.
That many.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, how do people keep track? Do they get a favorite and stick with it? Is that what you find?
A lot of the times, the basics, the chocolate, the vanillas, the black raspberry, French vanilla, so on and so forth, they stick with those. And then they like to have fun. They bring in different flavors for their customers to keep, you know, to draw the customers coming back and keep it exciting for their customers. So.
Now, you said that there was no lobster in it. I just wanted to tell you that we have in our neighborhood an ice cream shop called Oh Yeah. And they have a swirler machine. And they swirl the most bizarre things to get it. You pick it, and one of them was smoked salmon, and wasabi.
Oh, my word. I have heard, I don't know the name of the company or anything, but I have heard of someone actually putting lobster in ice cream before.
Oh, well, they're doing all kinds of mad things.
Yeah, that's not really up my alley, I guess.
Not even
ice cream.
Not even as a maniac.
Right. No, I mean, I probably would try it just to say that I did, but no, I like our lobster tracks without the actual lobster.
Now, this is a real family business, right?
Yeah, my mind again, Rabbit.
I do that.
You started out as a dairy farm?
Yes. Well, I didn't, but my grandmother, Audrey, my grandfather, Randall, did with my father, John, and Uncle Roger, and then they took over Hunt's Dairy in Skowhegan, Maine, which was a dairy production manufacturing facility. And then in they had excess milk and cream, and they started making small batches of ice cream. And then we opened our first family-owned ice cream stand in Skowhegan, Maine. And then my grandfather and grandmother decided to sell the milk aspect of the business, and my handed it over to my dad and uncle. My dad and uncle decided they wanted to take a big risk, and they went with all ice cream, manufacturing ice cream, and here we are today.
So well, how do you distribute it?
We have distributors throughout New England into New York and New Jersey
that pick up
the ice cream here, or we have a trailer load shipped down to them.
So for listeners who are further away than the northeastern United States, what do you do? I mean, we're telling them what wonderful ice cream it is. Is it possible to get it? Even though you don't live in the area where it's distributed?
Yes, it is possible. They can go onto our website, www.giffordsicecream.com, and they can email info@giffordsicecream.com, and they can let us know where they're from, what they're looking for. We can get them the price cost. And I will tell you a quick little story. We had a couple out of, I believe it was Texas, and it was going to be his fiancée's birthday, and she was originally from Maine, and she just loved our ice cream. So he had product all the way from Maine shipped to Texas for her to surprise her. It was a really cute story.
Aww.
Well, we got a surprise like that, too. And when the package came, I can tell you, with the dry ice inside, Anne opened the chocolate ice cream right away and tried to dig in with a spoon, and it bent the spoon.
Our chocolate is excellent in a frap.
Now, when we said that it's the best chocolate ice cream in the country, I mean, this is not just made up. You just won this title for
yourself. Oh, yes. This is the second time that we've won World Best Chocolate, which is judged at the World Dairy Expo in Madison, Wisconsin. There's a panel of judges. They vote on creaminess, the texture,
the flavor would be good.
The quality, the color, appearance, body and texture, flavor, and they blind test it. And actually this year we received a perfect score, so we received 100%, which we were all very excited about, because we don't like to brag, but it's rare for a perfect score.
Well, I believe it, though. It really is good.
It used to be considered impossible until Mary Lou Retton from Fairmont County, West Virginia, did it in the Olympic Games. I forget what year it was. And now they get people on Dancing with the Stars getting 30 out of 30, but not so many.
Exactly.
100%.
Exactly. Everything is possible.
100% on chocolate ice cream sounds like a really, real wow. Now, these must be really thin judges, right?
Excuse me?
They must be really thin judges.
Judge ice cream.
Yeah, right. I wish I could be a judge.
There you go.
That'd be a fun job.
So do you eat ice cream all the time?
Oh, yes, I definitely do. I try to be as good as possible, but I have a flapper or a sundae or something, a couple times a week.
Well,
and we're always sampling during the day at work.
Well, why wouldn't you do that? And this is a wonderful family story from the state of Maine. This is worth getting shipped, listeners. It really is. It's not just a matter of surprising your fiance who's from Maine. If you want to enjoy the very best with a 100% score, you know where to get it now.
And you know, it's really good for breakfast, I have to tell you.
our grape nut, we've had our grape nut ice cream, we've had customers have a scoop of that with maple syrup over it.
Oh, shoot, for breakfast,
yeah,
huh?
So there you go. There's your post-grape nut cereal with some syrup over it for breakfast.
We didn't have that one. That's amazing.
Well, let's do this. We better terminate this interview, because last night's menu for dinner in our household was buffalo chili with chocolate ice cream for dessert. And guess what we're going to have for lunch? And I only got halfway through.
Some more ice cream.
I got halfway through. I had the chili. Now I need to get the ice cream.
Lindsay, it's been a delight talking to you.
Thank you.
And I'm so, we found out about it, of course, when you won the contest. I mean, what better than to be called the best chocolate ice cream in the whole country?
Right.
Congratulations to you and to your family, and keep those flavors coming.
We will. We'll do our very best.
Thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Forking fantastic.
Say that fast four times.
Forking fantastic promises to be quite an adventure, and it is, which is why we have Tamara and Zora.
Yeah, Tamara Reynolds and Zora O'Neill. Now, those are interesting names. Where do they derive from?
My mother named me after her laundry lady in Morocco. So I have a proud legacy to live up to.
Is that Zora? Is that Zora or Tamara?
That's Zora.
Yeah. Zora, okay.
I was named Heather for the first 2 days, and then when my mom was getting checked out of the hospital, my father went and changed my name on the birth certificate to Tamara without consulting my mom.
Tamara needs to look at her little sign.
And I guess he got it from Dr. Zhivago.
Okay.
And you know what, listeners, if you think these people are fun, you're right, and so is their book, which is called Forking Fantastic, Put the Party Back in Dinner Party. It's hysterical. I mean, I don't know, and I feel like I know you both.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. I'm so glad you like it. That's great.
But this is sort of like a potluck dinner, except that you do all the work.
Right.
Explain first of all, what the book consists of, and secondly, how you got to doing what you're doing. First, what is the book? It's sort of memoir, but with recipes and attitude. It has a lot of attitude.
Yeah, I think it's sort of... I tell people it's sort of like a chick flick meets a cookbook, right? And sort of a how-to for grand projects that you never really imagined yourself doing that involve fire and live, you know, whole animal bits and cinder blocks.
I love the part where one of your guests backed into the chicken in a can.
Oh, whoa. My husband. I see that scar every morning, that poor man.
Oh, no.
Poor Carl.
Oh, dear.
He really took one for the team that night.
Yeah, well, I burned my forearm very badly on our son's very bad grill, which he is in a bad place, and then he doesn't have the right tools. And
no.
So it's dangerous.
And I'm using the longest possible tongs.
I have so far resisted the temptation of saying, I'm fed up with you having a lousy grill. I'm going to buy you one.
That's just what he's going for.
I suspect that's probably in there somewhere, but this is not just a backyard grill cookbook. This is a whole lot more than that.
Yes.
I mean, I think, first of all, it's a philosophy of life almost, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. I feel like we are saying something that a lot of people maybe have thought about but haven't seen anyone else say, so they're not sure it's the okay thing to do, and we can say confidently, we've been living this way for years. It works out fine, and everybody loves it. Like, you don't have to have anything match. You don't have to put in a pretty centerpiece. You don't have to do any of that extra. There's all this extra stuff that goes along with the dinner party these days, which it seems unnecessary. As long as you have your friends there and you have food and you have a bottle of wine, you're good. Yeah.
But how did you get there? You taught yourself to cook. And, how did you... Tell us your stories.
Well, I, Zora... Actually, it was funny. When we wrote the cookbook, we both wrote down... There's a little section in the beginning of the book comparing how we both learned to cook. And in a way, it's a very similar story. Tamara and I are both happen to be from the Southwest. I'm from New Mexico. She's from Arizona. I don't think that's a big factor necessarily, but it just so happens. I happened to grow up in a family where we were on food stamps a lot of the time, but my parents actually cared about good food, and they were able to make really great food on a budget. And so I grew up knowing what good food tasted like, but I didn't actually learn how to cook until I was in college. Well, actually, in graduate school. And then I had tons of time on my hands, because I was kind of bored with what I was supposed to be studying. So I spent a lot of time reading Cooks Illustrated and experimenting on my roommates. And by the time I moved to New York, where apparently I was not aware of this, but in New York, nobody cooks.
Right.
I had no idea.
Right.
And so
true.
I innocently showed up in New York, and I was like, so where do you guys buy groceries? Like, I don't want an apartment where there's not a grocery store nearby. So I ended up actually moving to... The place I moved into the neighborhood here in Queens based solely on the fact that there were 24-hour produce stands.
Oh, dear.
And so I just kept cooking, and, like, I couldn't afford not to cook. I couldn't afford to live on takeout. I mean, I don't know how people do it in New York, so I was very much in the habit of cooking dinner for myself every night.
And as
she said, Tamara, we had very similar stories, grew up with families who cooked. It just so happens that my father was a chef until I was eight, and my grandfather was a master chef for his entire life. He's still alive.
That's wonderful.
My family had her working in their Austrian bakery when she was tall enough to roll dough out. She was 4 years old, and once she could reach the counter, they put her to work. So,
oh, wow. That's interesting about the Austria. We have an interview coming up with, did you read Confessions of a Closet Master Baker?
No, but I feel like I should.
Oh, you should. This is this woman is Sandra Pollock's sister.
Sandra Bullock.
Bullock. Her name is Jacine.
The only Pollocks who are famous are Fish and guys who used to play cricket for South Africa.
I see.
Oh, really?
No, it's Bullock. Sandra Bullock's sister wrote this.
Cool.
So she was a Hollywood dropout.
Well, I couldn't let the preparation thing go by without saying that you have no respect for anybody, so you did say some rather unpleasant things about Martha Stewart getting ready for a dinner party.
It's not that we have no respect for her, it's that...
I was just reading her magazine last night on the subway, actually. I felt a little guilty, but...
she
creates a beautiful world, but if you try to live in that world, it's impossible, and you will always be disappointed and never feel like you're doing anything right. So you can read that magazine like once a month or something and fantasize. Just don't try to implement it.
The idea of using that as my guide for daily living makes me want to poke my eyes out with hot coals.
Well, anyway, let's get back inside.
Oh, I wanted to say just one thing, actually, is what do you think of Gourmet magazines closing?
I'm so sad. I'm personally heartsick. I learned to cook from Gourmet magazines.
Oh, yeah, I used to buy them at yard sales.
I decided to learn to cook, that was when I sort of woke up in my first marriage and thought, you know, how hard can it be? And I picked up Gourmet because in my mind that was the pinnacle of good cooking, and that's where I should learn to cook. And that's how I learned. I cooked every recipe in Gourmet for months and months and months on end. Some very unsuccessfully, and I learned through trial and error, and I'm just...
And that's one of the things you put out for your readers in this book, is don't be afraid. You started out with saying, start slow, right? If you could only boil an egg. But then you go on to part about just jump in and try it, like roasting a whole lamb on a spit.
Well, the sad thing is that On the Menu has a subscription to Gourmet magazine going to about 2015.
I think we do too.
I know.
Let's jump back into the covers of this book, because it's got, aside from a fascinating story, which will have you just in stitches, just listening to how these ladies describe their adventures
and their tips.
There are lots and lots of very sensible tips all the way through the book. And
what about Sunday Night Suppers? And, we haven't even talked
about
that.
Well, that's the whole thing. The Forking Fantastic is about how to create these... They're events. I mean, they're not just dinner parties with eight people around a cozy table. They're 20 people at a time.
Explain what this is about.
Well, when Zora and I first met, we were working at a restaurant. She was working as a line cook, and I was working as a waitress, and met over a very alcohol-soaked Christmas party, and had a great, you know, fell in love at this Christmas party, but then shared a cab home because we discovered we lived in the same neighborhood in Astoria, Queens, but woke up the next morning and couldn't remember anything about the other person except that we thought that they were cool. So then a couple of weeks later, Zora invited me to her then friend, now husband, Peter's apartment, and he was making a big to-do for his name day. He's Greek, and I was so excited to go, so excited to meet people who lived in my neighborhood because all of my friends lived in Manhattan. But I get there, and there's all this amazing food and all of these really interesting people, and nothing matches, and the bathroom had obviously not been shined to within an inch of its life, and I could feel, like, my head spinning around like I was in The Exorcist, you know. I was like, you can have people over if your house isn't spotless? What? Yes, I feel like that's my
great contribution to humanity. Actually, you don't have to clean your house.
So anyhow, so this led to this.
So this sort of led to us, we started to cook together, and then we started to have people over. Because we would think of these great projects to cook, and you know, if you're gonna cook a whole pork shoulder, well, then you need six or seven people to eat it. And people started coming. It was always on Sunday because it was sort of, I think, around the HBO Sunday night lineup. And then the next thing we knew, everyone wanted to invite friends, and we said they could because I can't say no to anything ever, I guess. And then we were broke at the end of the month, and we were like, wait a minute, how is this possible? We make, because we're feeding, like, 20 people a week. Oh, okay. So then we asked for $15, but people put in 20, and that gave everyone license to invite whoever they wanted, because then they felt like it was now...
Right, they weren't taking advantage.
Right.
They were paying their share.
Right. So. And then it suddenly, we were running a supper club, and we didn't even know that was what we were doing. We just... were cooking because it was fun, and having dinner parties because it was a nice way to wind up your week and eat together around one table and eat everything family style, and it was just a good time.
Well, it sounds like fun.
Now you've also got some really bold recipes.
Yes.
So let's do a couple of those. Bacon and chicken is one I guess everyone knows about. We actually have an official special tool for doing bacon
and
chicken.
They send us one.
Oh, right. I've seen those. They're probably a little bit more stable than an actual beer can, which is a bonus.
Not only
but
that.
But you don't get to drink the beer beforehand.
Oh, yes, you can.
Oh, well, I guess
you just open two.
Like we need an excuse.
But then you've got some great lamb recipe with the lamb recipes for smaller amounts of lamb, and then you've got a whole leg of, is it a whole lamb or...
There's the whole roast lamb, and then I think you're talking about the leg of lamb with the pomegranate molasses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which I feel like between that and maybe the fried chicken, I feel like those are sort of our most popular dishes. We get people who... Oh, and the ham.
And the ham.
The ham people are always clamoring for. But I feel like the lamb, the leg of lamb, we kind of created more ourselves, so I feel... Yeah,
now, I think there's another thing I'd like to explore with you, because I'm an outdoor cooker. When Anne wasn't well and I was taking care of her, I would have to cook the main course outside on the barbecue grill, even if it was the middle of winter, because I didn't know how to time things
on the stove.
I didn't really, I hardly knew how to turn it on.
Right.
So I'd be cooking vegetables inside and cooking the meat outside. So it was quite an adventure to do that. But I did learn lots of things. But what you've done, I think, that's really exciting is you not only have one dish, which is what I used to create, you have a whole menu. So you've got five or six things, all of which you've decided go together.
Yeah, I feel like that helps people. Part of the trouble I think people have in cooking is there's so much stuff out there. There's so many recipes. There are a million cookbooks. And how do you even begin to pick one thing? And then once you pick one thing, how do you pick the sides? I feel like... We give people these menus because the flavors go together and balance each other out, and we've also worked that we have the little plan of attack section, we call it, so it's a step-by-step thing explaining what order you want to prepare everything in. So, you know, we've taken into account that not everything has to be cooked on the stovetop, and, you know, while this one thing is cooking, you can be prepping the vegetables for another thing. So hopefully we'll make it a little bit easier for people who might not ordinarily prepare four or five dishes at once and would think that's too intimidating.
No, I think it's
that's a secret.
I think it's a wonderful instruction set as to how to go about it. And
funny, I mean, you have little tips like hoard management.
Oh, we're very experienced in that.
Oh,
let me tell you, every one of those learned from our mistakes is hard-won knowledge.
Oh,
yes.
Well,
no matter how stupid they seem, we've actually done those things.
I think you've just produced a wonderful book. I mean, it's just a delight to read. And you've got plenty of great endorsements from people, including good old Tony Bourdain.
Oh, we're very pleased with that. That was so gratifying to hear from him.
Oh, yeah. And I just congratulations to you. And I think people really ought to get this and relax a little bit, get a little bit more laid back about this whole entertaining thing.
Okay.
We hope so.
Yes.
We hope so. And maybe they'll invite us over for dinner. That's the best part. Please.
Okay. So the book is called Forking Fantastic, Putting the party back in, dinner party. For those of you who have a nervous disposition, be aware of the fact that there are four-letter words inside this book.
Thank you for warning them.
And so the people aren't shocked by that. But I'm just looking forward to trying some of these matches, because several dishes here, like the beer can chicken, are in my repertoire, but I always wondered what to cook with them, and now I'll know, and I'll know how. Do you have an ongoing website presence? Do you have a blog or anything like that?
Well, for the website, for the book itself, we do have a website, forkingfantastic.com, and we have a lot of photos. There are a lot of photos on there of dishes that are not in the book. The recipes are in the book, but we don't have photos. So okay. I know I've heard from a lot of people, they're curious how a lot of the other things look. Right. So you can go to the website and check out photos. And we're going to have wine recommendations and music recommendations and other tips up there as well.
Yeah. Well, Tamara and Zora, thank you so much for joining us today. What fun. And I hope we have a rain check for some time over in Manhattan.
You are always welcome.
We'll get in touch. We know I know where Queens is. I'm not sure Anne's ever been there, but
I was there once.
Many people through this very difficult, yes.
I was there in college.
Ladies, keep up the great work. I can't imagine what you'll do for an encore, but I have a feeling there'll be one.
I hope so.
Good to meet you both, and good to talk to you.
Great to talk to you.
Thank you so much
for having us.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay, so we're at that time again, the end of a program. We hope you've enjoyed sharing it with us. We hope you'll have a wonderful, wonderful Thanksgiving with whoever you're sharing it with, and that the tips in today's program will make it even better than it would have been otherwise.
Okay, and until then, after Thanksgiving Day, we're going to say
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.